Okay, now we have some time for questions and dialogue, comments, whatever you want to do. Yes?
I'm curious, why do you think it is that we are more reckless with the people we're closest with?
Why do I think that we're more reckless with the people that we're closer with? Because I think sometimes that we have more trust, you know, and we go a little, and we have a good kind of trust, but then we take advantage of the trust. And we feel this person is so much a part of me that I don't need to be mindful of what I say or do around them. I can just be spontaneous. You know, I can be myself. I trust them so much. I can just be myself. So if I'm in a bad mood, I can just let myself be in a bad mood. You know, and so it might be because we're abusing that trust, but we're doing it. We're not recognizing we're abusing the trust. We're doing it in the name of trust. Or sometimes I think we feel that the people we're close to are so much a part of ourselves that we don't need to treat them with regular human manners and regular common culturally expected levels of being polite. Yeah. So we just, I live with this person. I don't need to be polite to them. I don't need to say thank you when they do something kind. I don't need to praise them when they do something well. You know, I can just let all my bad moods come out and be spontaneous because they're going to love me anyway, no matter how I act. Or they're so much part of me anyway. Okay? And so I think that might be going on, you know, in our minds. I talked about this one time in Coeur d'Alene when I was giving some teachings there and how we do this. And I got an email a couple of weeks later from one of the women at the course. And she said, you know, when you were talking about how we think our loved ones are so much a part of us that we stop respecting them, I didn't really understand what you meant. But then when you gave us the homework assignment, because I would give people homework assignments, you gave us the homework assignment of checking up our expectations about, you know, the people in our life. She said, I really began to see this. And she gave an example of what really irritated her about her husband was that he would ask so many questions, you know, and her expectation behind it was that he should know what the answers were because she knew what the answers were. Or he should have all the information necessary to answer the question because she knew the answer to the question. Okay? And she said, oh, you know, what a stupid expectation to have that somebody else should have the same knowledge that I do or think in the same way I do. But she said, if that's not thinking that that person's a part of me, what is? Yeah? And so sometimes with the people we're close to, we expect them to think in the same way, to have the same knowledge, to approach things in the same way. And that's really kind of a false expectation. And then, you know, they have their own mind, their own way of looking at things. They may have more knowledge about it than we do. They may have less knowledge about it than we do. You know, but we expect them to be exactly the same as us. Kind of dumb. But, you know, it makes us really irritated with the people that we're close to. And then we often take it out on them. How do you work to repair those expectations? I think the first thing is to notice when we're having them. Yeah. And that's part of this mental factor of vigilance. You know, and it entails scratching below the surface of what are my expectations, because lots of times our expectations are completely unconscious. We have no idea they're there, you know, and it's only after we make ourselves and others so miserable that we begin to notice them. Okay? So sometimes when you feel yourself getting agitated or irritated with somebody, just to stop, or when you go home, you know, sit on your meditation cushion and say to yourself, what was I expecting of that person? Okay? And we may come up with things of, well, I was expecting that because, you know, they're married to me, that they're always going to be in the same mood I am, and that whenever I'm depressed, they're always going to pull me out of my depression. Is that a fair expectation to have of somebody you're married to? I don't think so. You expect them to always be in the same mood as you? What would you do if they said to you, I expect you to be always in the same mood as me? You'd go, sorry, you know, I can't guarantee I'm going to do that. I can't guarantee I'm always going to pull you out of your depression. But we expect that from other people, okay? So sometimes just realizing, wow, you know, that expectation is totally unrealistic. This person is their own individual. I got to love them because they're their own person. Now, let's drop that expectation and try and accept them the way they are. Or sometimes we just notice our expectations usually have the word should in them. Okay? Yeah. They shouldn't smoke. Yeah. They shouldn't eat sugar. They shouldn't eat meat. They shouldn't cough so loud. Yeah, I mean, because we let all this really come out with the people we're close to. We pick on every little detail, you know. They shouldn't cut their toenails in the bedroom. They should cut their toenails in the bathroom. You know, they shouldn't turn the cups upside down. They should turn the cups right side up in the cupboard. I mean, we can get so picky. Yeah, you know. And so to look at those expectations, why should they put the cups right side up in the cupboard? Because I think right side up is the most sanitary way to keep the cups in the cupboard. Well, they think that putting them upside down is the most sanitary way. Why do I need to hang on to my idea of what's right? Okay? So just kind of becoming aware of these expectations and then questioning if they're valid. No? And often we'll find, like especially when you're working together with other people, maybe you're on a committee working with people or you're at work and, you know, you're organizing some project together, and you find yourself getting really irritated with somebody, you know, because of their opinions, and then you stop and say, well, why am I so irritated? Well, because they should do things my way. Okay? They should see that my opinion is the best way. They should know that I have so many years of experience in this field and that undoubtedly the way I think is the only true, right way to approach this problem. Yeah? And we begin to see that we have that kind of expectation of the other people that we're working on the project with, and that's what leads us to get so completely annoyed with them. You know, because, hey, they don't have the same life experience as we do. And, hey, they don't think that our ideas are number one because they may have different ideas because they've had different life experience, because they have different information, or because they have different things in this project that are important to them. The things that I think are important maybe aren't the things they think are important. I need to open my mind and consider what they think is important. Okay? So stuff like that.
I have a question.
Uh-huh.
Because I recently heard of a man from India who is a Buddhist monk in the Jain tradition, and he spoke about how we create peace in the world along the same lines about what you're talking about. And he was talking about our culture, the society that we live in America, and because he's here now, apparently, and how recently he visited Europe and went to England and went to the United States Embassy, and he noticed how it was a very difficult place to get into because of barbed wire fences and guard dogs, and I mean it was just kind of intimidating for him, you know. And then he said, but you can go over to the Norwegian embassy or to the Swedish embassy or to the Swiss embassy, and it says, the people welcome you any time of day. You know? And so my question is, how do we, I probably already know the answer, but how do we, you know, in this world that we live in where this kind of attitude is so pervasive, you know, how do we work with that continually every day that we wake up? I mean, if it's that pervasive, you know, where your neighbors are kind of like afraid, like how do you help them not be so afraid, you know?
Okay, so you're talking about mistrust.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, how do we handle mistrust on a personal level and also as a country, you know, with this example of how our embassies are so loaded with, you know, surveillance equipment and barbed wire and guard doors and you know, guard dogs and rifles and everything else. I think you smile and you be cheerful and you act as if you don't buy into it. You act as if it's not happening. Okay? For example, I do prison work. Okay? A couple of weeks ago, I went into the prison at Statesville. You know, Statesville prison in Joliet, which is one of the really, really bad prisons in Illinois. That's where they used to house the mafia. They used to house the Chicago gangs. And I've been in a lot of prisons, and there's a certain prison mentality. This is exactly what you spoke of, you know, with the guards on the defensive and ready to, you know, just, there's a whole power dynamic going on in the prisons of the guards, you know, treating the inmates like infants and pushing them down, and then there's all these respect issues among the inmates, and there's all this distrust when you come to visit, you know, because if you're not dressed properly, they won't let you in, and if your name is misspelled, they won't let you in, and I mean, it's just incredible what goes on. And, yeah, fear, mistrust, power games, prison really exemplifies the whole thing. What I do before I go on a prison visit, so I do Chenrezig meditation, I do the self-generation, I'm Chenrezig, and Chenrezig goes into that prison. And I just think, how does Chenrezig deal with this? Chenrezig smiles at all the guards, you know, talks to them, hello, how are you, how do you like your job, you know, how did you start doing this? Now, take an interest in these people. They're human beings instead of just going, oh, this is an unfriendly guard. You know, be friendly to them. Treat them as a human being with feelings. You know, treat the inmates like that. Smile, crack a joke. Yeah, just go in and as you're walking down the corridors instead of, you know, because everybody there, you know, like, who do you walk? You go down the corridors, you look at the guys, and you smile, you say hello, and, you know, you just pretend it's not there, and you're Chenrezig, and you bring your good energy right into the environment. Okay? And what I noticed when I was there, the chaplain, there were two chaplains who had arranged my visit. The first one was the usual chaplain. He lost my papers, you know, so I had to send them again, and I had to make I don't know how many phone calls, and, you know, the memo still hadn't been sent in, and this is the standard thing that happens in prison, you know. And the second chaplain, he was really on top of it. He got the memo in. He came out, and I was just astounded. He was smiling, you know, he was chatting with the guards as we were walking in. He was smiling at the other guys. The inmate, because I was giving the one inmate bodhisattva vows, he went and escorted Raymond, and he was chatting with Raymond, and at the end of the visit, he gave Raymond some tea, some of his own personal tea. I mean, for a staff member to give an inmate something, this doesn't happen. He gave Raymond some tea bags. He let him keep all the stuff I had brought in for him, stuff like that. And the guy was just smiling. And, you know, and I commented about that to him. I said, you know, you have a really good attitude, and it's really nice, and you know, keep going. And he said, yeah, I have to. I just don't let it get to me, yeah, because I want to be happy. And as a result, he brings so much joy into the environment that he works with. Yeah? And that begins to increase the trust amongst the people that you come in contact with. Yeah? So I think if we just approach people and things that way, yeah, I mean, people who are doing power trips, you just go in, you act as if you didn't even notice they're doing a power trip. Yeah, or people who are just suspicious or whatever, you just don't notice it. Or people, imagine having the job, imagine being at the U.S. Embassy that you were talking about, and having the job of having to search everybody and look at all of their ID, and being afraid for your own life because there's been so many bomb threats. I mean, is that a job you would want to do? I wouldn't want to be a guard at a U.S. embassy. I mean, but just think, wow, here's this human being, and somebody has to do this job, and it's actually very kind that they're doing it. And if I can go in and be friendly and happy and take interest in them and learn about them, and I mean, they may have had all kinds of interesting experiences, and they probably really appreciate somebody being nice to them. Yeah, then you just bring your good energy with. Questions? Yeah.
I'm just wondering, because I think in our society we are so saturated with different images or just so many external things that are coming in that sometimes even to stop and to monitor ourselves, to be mindful, to distinguish maybe even the difference between, anger and attachment, sometimes I think that it's even hard to get to that point. I was just wondering, because if you can realize something and notice that it's there, it's a lot easier to change it. But even getting to that point where you can really get down and look at your life and analyze, this action is creating suffering because it's anger and attachment or it's hatred. Because if you can find what the problem is, it's much easier to find the antidote.
Yeah.
So I was just wondering, how can you identify those things?
Yeah, okay. So you're saying that it's hard even to, with so much in our society bombarding us all the time, it's hard to have the time as well as the mental space to even notice what's going on in our mind.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let alone identify it and stuff like that. Okay, this gets back to something where I think we have to really take charge of our own lives and prioritize what's important and live according to what we think is important, because we're the ones that let the media bombard us. Okay? We're the ones that let all this stuff in. We don't have to read the newspaper every day. We don't have to surf the net every day. We don't have to turn on the radio when we're in the car. We don't have to turn on the TV when we're at home. We don't have to flip through all the magazines when we're at the dentist's office. Okay? So we don't have to read all the billboards as we drive past them. Yeah? So I think one of the things is, you were referring to so much information coming at us that we get confused and we don't know what to focus on and we don't have any mental space. To just recognize, okay, how am I getting oversaturated with information that I don't need? And then cutting off those information sources, And I think taking the TV out of your house is the first thing to do. Especially if you have kids, Do you want your kid growing up? No wonder kids have ADD. They watch way too much TV. Yeah, and I think that causes a lot of the ADD. So, you stop your subscriptions, you stop your, you get rid of your television. Yeah. Maybe you get the Sunday paper, or you get one news magazine, so you keep, you keep up. When you get in the car, you play a Dharma tape, or you actually talk to the person. You talk to your family member when you're in the car, or maybe you actually sit in silence and enjoy the ride but you don't to really take charge of our lives, and we don't need to have noise around us and information around us all the time. Yeah? I mean, we can choose what we think is important. And similarly, we are the ones who can set our daily schedule. And part of our problem, like you were saying, of, you know, not seeing these things in us, is that we don't make the time to sit and do some daily reflection, you know, either some meditation or reading a Dharma book or just even checking in with ourselves and generating our motivation in the morning, checking in with ourselves in the evening how we did. Why don't we have time to do that? We're too busy talking on the phone. We're too busy going out to eat. We're too busy running errands on multiple days that we could consolidate so we run them all on one day and save ourselves time. You know, to really look at our lives and how we're spending our time and how we feed into our own restlessness and keep ourselves so busy. And people say, well, you know, I've got to do all these things. And I don't think so. I don't think we have to do all these things. And if you're having a hard time finding quiet time to meditate, what you do is you take out your daytime diary, you know, your calendar, and you write in 6:30 to 7 o'clock every morning, appointment with the Buddha. Okay? 7:30 in the evening to 8:30 in the evening, appointment with the Buddha. When you have an appointment, you keep your appointments, don't you? Especially when you have one with the Buddha. You know, you don't stand the Buddha up and say, sorry, you know. You're an enlightened being. I know you'll understand if I don't make it. No, you keep your appointment, you know, because the Buddha's important. You respect the Buddha. Okay? And then that time, that way, you have time to do your meditation practice. And if somebody calls you and says, look, I've got to see you at 7:30 tonight, you say, I'm sorry, I have a very important appointment that I can't break. I'll see you before that, or I'll see you after, or I'll see you tomorrow. But I have a very important appointment at that time, and I can't break it. You know, so you write it, and I mean, I tell you, write it in your diary. You have an appointment with the Buddha, and then you keep your appointment, and then you have time. Yeah, then you can sit, you can read a little bit, you can contemplate, you can meditate. Hmm? Yeah.
In your discussion of the three mental factors, you had mentioned your enemy, and I think I guess good for conscientiousness, because mm-hmm. I found that. I was just wondering if there was one for conscientiousness.
Oh, a near enemy for conscientiousness. Let me think about that. Yeah. Cherishing our attachments. Okay? So, conscientiousness, you know, cherishes. She was asking, what's the near enemy for conscientiousness? You know, conscientiousness cherishes what's virtuous. Sometimes we rationalize and we cherish our attachments, pretending that they're conscientiousness. Okay. What's a good example? I can't go to Dharma class tonight because I really need to go out to dinner with my family and go to a movie with my family. We haven't done anything fun for the last 2 days together, and so I really have to go. Otherwise, it's not being very nice to my family, and I want to be kind to my family, or I want to be kind to my friends and do this. Actually, what's motivating us is attachment. You know, we want to go out and have a good meal, go to a movie, go out drinking. You know, we want to just indulge our attachments, but we rationalize it and say, oh, it's for the benefit of others, when it's really not. Okay? So something like that. We often rationalize things for the benefit of others. Yeah, but it's actually just feeding our attachment. You know, because if our family were asking them to paint the house at that time, we would definitely have time to come to the Dharma class. Wouldn't we? You know, or if our friend was asking for help to move, oh, I'm sorry, I've got to go to Dharma class. But when our friend is asking us to go out to dinner and to a movie, oh yeah, you know, I've got to do it for their welfare, for their benefit. Okay, so we rationalize. Okay, let's just sit quietly for a couple of minutes. In this meditation, please we'll meditate maybe about 5 minutes. Please use this to reflect on your life and to identify these mental factors and make examples of them in your lifetime and to start cultivating the virtuous mental factors.